welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. This is episode 163, and it is part two of our conversation with Billy Malls about hunting in Alaska, and specifically hunting caribou. We get into much more in this conversation, more into the details about meat care and encounters with grizzlies and all those topics that for someone like myself who's only hunted the lower 48, I have those questions about this upcoming Alaska hunt and this caribou hunt, and I was super excited to talk with Billy about that and learn from his experiences. So again, that's just a bit of what we cover in this episode. There's a lot of good stuff here. So thank you guys for tuning in. I hope you enjoy this one. We always say it, we always mean it. We do this because of you guys, because of the feedback, and hopefully because we can help you in your next adventures. So whatever that is for you, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for a future show, go ahead and reach out. Send us an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. If you're enjoying the show, leave us a review in iTunes. That helps us tremendously. And yeah, let's dive into this one, part two of our conversation with Billy Malls. Well, Billy, welcome back to the show. Thanks for taking the time to join us for a part two here.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy to be here, guys.
Yeah, listeners are probably getting these two episodes back to back, but we're actually weeks removed from when we recorded the first episode with you, and so I'm excited to get back and talk to you again. Before we dive back into the caribou stuff, as we record this, it's December 3rd, and there was just a pretty significant earthquake up in Alaska. I was just kind of curious from you personally, Billy, if you've been in contact with folks or kind of have any personal on the ground reports or damage assessments or anything like that from the earthquake in Alaska and how that might affect things there for a bit.
Well, I don't watch television, so I don't have, you know, what most people have seen on the news. I haven't seen. I was actually speaking with some friends of mine, texting them, communicating with them by text when it happened. So they're okay. Everybody I know is all right, but I've seen on social media a lot of people's taxidermy mounts haven't fared so well. So one friend of mine, they didn't want to go in their house because of all the aftershocks, and so they just stayed all night drinking tequila as they had a big bonfire. I guess it was a pretty good reason to have a party, apparently.
It's the old earthquake celebration. I like it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I guess that's as good a reason as any. Safety first, you know?
That's funny. Nothing says safety like bonfire and tequila.
Amen.
All right, cool. We covered so much good ground in that first episode and, you know, kind of ended with talking about some shooting opportunities and shooting distances and approaches and things of that nature. I'm kind of curious just to start this conversation and dive in some after shot topics. And first of all, specifically, as you talk about hunting caribou and, you know, you're at the time of the year where you could potentially get them in velvet or they could be in the midst of, shedding that velvet. What advice do you have specifically if someone's there hunting full velvet and wants to care for that rack in the field, say they have, you know, another 4 days before they're flown out of there? What can they do to help care for that rack and that velvet?
Okay, good question. Yeah, usually if you've got 4 days, like you said, and you've got access to like a creek or a pothole or a pond or something, then you could strip off the velvet, soak it in the water, but don't do it if, let's say, the plane's going to pick you up in 2 days. I wouldn't peel the velvet. I'd just leave it on because you're going to have a bloody mess right afterwards. So, yeah, 4 days. If you want to peel it off, do so. But if it's any closer to your pickup time than that, probably just leave the velvet. If you're real late in August, generally in the Arctic, the bulls start shedding their velvet around August 25th, kind of the norm. By early September, it's really, really loose. At that point, you probably might as well just peel it off. You know, if it's falling off, I would just go ahead and peel it. Try to soak it, get rid of the blood as much as you can. So that's probably about the best advice I'd have for dealing with the velvet.
Okay. So when you say soak it, the main purpose there is just to get rid of some of that blood?
Yeah. Yep. The blood will wash out. Yeah, it'll just kind of dilute it out. And most guys anymore, I'm not real familiar with it, but I know some taxidermists will freeze dry the velvet. So if the velvet's in good tack, intact really well, that's probably the route I would go. Flocking is okay. I've never seen any flocking that really truly looks lifelike or realistic. But obviously the freeze dried method is going to be a little better. Not sure what the cost difference is there. But if it were me, if I wanted to keep the velvet, I would go with freeze drying.
Okay. Is flocking, is that the synthetic stuff?
The flocking is correct. Yeah, then they'll peel off all the real velvet, then they basically paint with a paste and then flock it with synthetic fiber.
Cool. So meat care, this is a big one for me. I'm so used to hunting where there's trees, and I'm thinking of this Arctic caribou hunt and thinking of it being very barren from trees. And then obviously I want to get into cautions with predators, but first, just in general meat care, what advice do you have for people who are, you know, new to Alaska and maybe have this lower 48 experience where they might be, you know, hanging meat? Where do we start?
Any kind of brush that you can find, obviously, to keep it elevated. Bacteria grows with moisture, so rule number one is to get it dry. So that would mean getting it covered and allowing air to get all the way around it. If you have to lay it on the tundra, you definitely want to elevate it, but usually you can find something. What I generally do if I don't have anything is the caribou antlers work well. Don't split the horns, at least not initially. Leave the rack whole. Put the rack so basically as if the caribou's nose was down in the ground, and then his tops, the tips of his antlers would go into the tundra, and that gives you a platform to hang your meat off of. And put a trekking pole or something like that on either end, make a little lean-to shelter type canopy over top of it, and you're good to go. Just make sure it doesn't get wet, and that'll keep in 50 degree weather for, you know, a week if need be. So typically, obviously, it's getting pretty cool at night, but just keep it as dry as you can. That's 95% of it.
Yeah, good.
So game bags, definitely bring game bags. And most areas you can bone the meat. Most people would say it works better if you leave it on the bone. I usually leave the quarters on the bone. One big thing that I like to do, rather than cut the ribs in strips, most people are probably familiar with a rib roll. Try to keep the meat in as big a pieces as possible, or at least the ribs and the scrap meat, rather than just throwing it all together in a big ball. A lot of times that seems to spoil a little bit quicker if you got a big 70-pound bag of loose meat, or if you do, jumble it up and rotate that once in a while.
Steve definitely has some rib roll experience now, don't you?
Yeah, I learned the technique like last year, and it's like mind-blowing. Yeah,
yeah.
Can't believe I didn't do it for the prior 15 years.
I literally, as we were working on that elk this September, I was like, I saw excitement in your eyes when it came to doing the rib roll.
It's kind of fun.
Well, yeah. It's kind of like a piece of art.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Like, if you could finish with that perfectly clean rib cage, you did a good job.
So yeah, if you don't know what the rib roll is, I'm sure it's on YouTube or something.
Yeah, and of course, that's a good piece to eat too, especially late in the hunt when you're craving fat. Save one side of ribs, start a fire, and cook it. I mean, that's life is at its greatest there.
Nice. I'll have to try that one.
So predator precautions. I'm thinking particularly in grizz country. Do you advise Billy doing anything of, you know, keeping human scent around the meats? You know, if particular, like say we're on a group hunt, as we personally going to be, if we're going to be leaving that meat potentially for a bit, do you advise leaving some clothes or something around that in terms of human scent or any other precautions?
Yeah, I usually, you know, take a piss around the kill, obviously, as you know, or if you don't, it's something you definitely want to know. The antlers have to be your last load away from the kill site. So if you're packing away from your kill, you have to take 100% the meat before you ever move your antlers closer to your camp. So that's just one thing to be aware of. I'm sure you guys are aware of that.
Yeah, I've seen that in the regulations, which makes me think of a regulation question, not to get off topic, but you mentioned previously, we'll come back to the grizz stuff. There's different rules for different, I think, units potentially in Alaska on whether you can or cannot bone out. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And it's pretty clear in the reg books, but yes, some areas you can bone out different parts. The ribs is probably where there's the most differential. But yeah, it's in the reg, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Do you have any insight into why they have different rules for different units and not just a statewide regulation on that?
My guess is it has something to do with the, there's probably some political pressure to do in some of those areas. I know that influences it to some degree, namely the natives, you know, if they're having problems with the meat. I guess I don't know all the moving pieces as to why there's such a differential. I believe it has to do with some of the access into the areas. As far as if it's easier to get the meat out of it, I think that has some play in it. But yeah, I think there's a lot of, we've all wondered that. It shouldn't be that difficult, but it is what it is, I guess.
All right, so back to kind of predator and grizz precautions. Take a leak around the site, obviously. What are your thoughts on maybe leaving some clothing or something, or you just pretty much try to take a leak on it, check on it, that type of thing?
Yep, well, I don't take a leak on it. Maybe
well, yeah, not on it, on the site, I should say, not on the meat.
I often leave something behind. It doesn't hurt. That's not a foolproof method by any means, but it doesn't hurt. Aside from that, I usually always have a tarp with me. So if you don't pack it all out, first thing is make sure you butcher the thing that night, 100%. Caribou doesn't take too long. You don't want that laying on the tundra. So even if you don't get it packed all back to camp that day, at least have it 100% butchered. So one tarp, anyways, you can cover the meat that you leave behind, you know, an 8x10 tarp. And then from there, the next day you get back to it, pack out the rest of the meat, get it back to camp, keep it all. I like to keep it about 20 to 30 yards away from my tent. If you go any farther than that, if a bear wants it, he's definitely going to take it. I've had bears come in and steal it, and I've literally set it a few feet from my tent, and they'll still sneak in and steal it. They're very, very smart, particularly an old bear. I had one, the bugger stole some meat, and then he didn't come for 2 days. And then it was a real big stormy night, and so the tent was flapping. And I literally, like, I could have reached out my tent and grabbed the meat. Woke up in the morning, the meat was gone because I couldn't hear him, and he knew that. So they're a smart darn critter, but I always keep all the meat together straight out the door of the tent. Everybody knows where it is, you know, for a safety reason, and keep it close enough to kind of deter the bear. But at the end of the day, you know, you can tie some pots and pans to it. I've done that before to wake you up. The biggest thing that I've found is, if a bear's on your meat, don't take a pistol, don't yell, don't do anything. Just zip open your tent, stick the biggest rifle you can out the door, make sure the bear knows you're there at that point, 99% of the time he will, and don't give him any warning, just fire that rifle into the air. Usually it's at night, the muzzle blast, the fire, that big boom, 9 times out of 10, will scare him away at least for that night. If he runs away and he turns and he looks back within about 40 yards, that bear's going to be back. If he runs away for about 200 yards before he turns and looks back, you're probably rid of him. But I guarantee if he looks back within 50 yards, he's coming back. If that doesn't scare them, you're going to have issues. So the reason why I don't yell or anything like that is just like a kid. If you yell at them and it's not very severe and then there's no real repercussion, pretty soon he realizes you're not going to hurt him. So you want to do everything in your power to scare the wits out of him the very first time and hope he doesn't come back. A pistol, in my experience, 50% of the time, it just agitates the bear even more. So I don't use a pistol to scare a bear. I use a pistol basically I've never had to kill one in defense with a pistol, don't use the pistol to try to scare them unless that's really your last resort other than shooting it. Because a lot of times they just get all the more aggressive. So use the rifle, try to scare them the first go around. If you do get them coming into camp, that's where air taxi selection or outfitter selection is pretty key. Some guys, you're all on your own till pickup day. Other guys will recognize the danger and the problem and do what they can to come get your meat out of camp. So that's a big question for your outfitters. Like, hey, if we get a caribou down early, you know, can you come and pick it up early? Some guys, a lot of them will probably tell you yes. A lot of guys probably won't act on it as much as others. But some outfitters are really good about that, and that's a key question because it'll keep the meat a lot better, obviously, if they can get it back in town and hang it somewhere totally dry. But it also alleviates the problem or some of the problem for bears getting into camp. So that's a big question to ask your outfitter or air taxi. So that's probably about all I got on that topic.
Oh, that's good.
So what caliber of pistol do you pack on your pack or your hip belt?
I've got a 44 mag. I've got a Scandium Titanium Smith & Wesson, so it's like 26 ounces. So the only time that I really rely on that is when I'm sheep hunting. So if I'm caribou hunting, I usually bring a rifle. I carry a 375 H&H. Obviously, that's overkill for a caribou, but for the backup factor and the grizzly factor. So if I was hunting with a buddy, though, I mean, I wouldn't hesitate. Even when I'm guiding, maybe occasionally, if I'm just packing the meat out, I'll just carry that pistol, you know, just for self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
Any other advice for bear encounters? I mean, what you said there, just like that little tip on if they turn back within 40, 50 yards, they're probably coming. Like, those little things are really good to know about bear behavior and bear encounters. Not necessarily just an encounter in camp, but just in general, what other kind of basics would you have guys know about being in Alaska and being in grizz country?
If a bear stands up on his hind feet, usually, I'm not going to say that you're safe, but usually at that point, you've got the upper hand. He's standing up. Everything in nature happens for a reason and a purpose. That bear's standing up to try to intimidate you. Just like when you guys are out getting drunk and lippy at a bar, or we all are, and you start to get in a skirmish, what's the first thing the guy does? He tries to look as big as he can, right? He sticks his chest out, stands up tall, and sets his drink aside and acts like he's gonna kick the crap out of you. The bear, he's standing up because he's trying to intimidate you. So right there, that tells you he doesn't have a lot of confidence. He's sizing you up. So always stand your ground with a bear. If he's standing up, popping his teeth, you're in pretty good shape. Don't get too nervous. If he stays down low and starts to slink in like a cat, pins his ears back, and then tucks down into like predator stealth mode, don't crap your pants, but you're in trouble. That bear business. So be ready. There, it's probably time to, stand your ground with the guy next to you. Know who's gonna wing the warning shot, but whoever's with you, try to gather together so you look like one big massive unit, okay? Because if a bear thinks that you're three animals, that behooves him, because he's just gonna run in and try to figure that your guys are gonna scatter, and he's gonna take whichever one's easiest. So you want to look like one big unit, one big animal, one big adversary. If he's popping teeth, standing up, you're pretty good. A lot of times they'll bluff charge. I would say within 15 yards, if he's still coming, he probably ain't going to stop. I guess that's probably about my threshold of comfort. If he's still coming and he has that body language like he means business. I had a bear, actually my newest DVD that I'm coming out with here in about a week, called Spirit of a Sheep Hunter. we had a bear get into our camp. This thing wouldn't leave us alone. It was a matter of time before we had to kill him. Young bear wasn't being super aggressive, but, I mean, we'd wing 300 mag rounds over his head right in the dirt in front of him, and he wouldn't even flinch. Finally, the pilot was coming in to pick us up. We had killed a sheep the night before, and he had stolen our meat, like, right off of our tent. So the pilots were coming in to pick us up. We called them, and they said, yeah, we'll be there right away. And so we took our sleeping pad, a yellow Neo Air mattress, pulled it out, left it inflated, and went to set it on either end of a runway because the pilot hadn't landed there before. And the bear saw that sleeping pad, and that threw him off more than rifle fire. That's the only thing that kept us from having to kill that bear until the planes landed. And interestingly, we pack up our stuff, hop in the airplane, and we were just taxiing out and taking off, and that bear had already come back and was licking the blood off the willow bush where the meat had hung, and we're only 80 yards away in an airplane taking off. So they can be pretty darn brazen, so anything you can use to your advantage, you know, think outside the box. Yeah, that's probably about what I got for bear safety.
Yeah, wow. Have you ever, maybe personally or with a client, or probably know someone who's had to take a self-defense measure on a bear and actually shoot at, injure, or kill that bear?
Yeah, oh yeah, lots of guys. I've never had to shoot one in defense of life and property, wounded bears, you know, charging in the brush. Just had one this last fall. That one died at five steps away, so that one was rather exciting. But it definitely happens. I know one guy, the bear's head was in the vestibule of his tent, and he had used 20 rounds to try to scare the bear away. This was on the Alaska Peninsula. And his last round went into the bear's head as the bear was weaseling his head under the vestibule of his tent to try to get at his food. And so he shot him like 2 feet off the muzzle of his rifle. So the bear more or less died inside of his vestibule. So that's getting pretty darn close.
If someone has to go through that encounter, what's protocol? Like, is that just something you report as soon as you get back to town to fish and game? Or what should a hunter know if, God forbid, they have to, you know, defend themselves against a bear?
Yep, so you've got to skin it out. You've got to salvage on a grizzly bear only the hide. If you're in an area with a black bear where you would legally have to salvage the meat, you would have to salvage the meat. But for a grizzly bear, you would just have to salvage the hide and the skull. I don't know if it's 10 days, or I can't just remember the wording, but we always have sat phones and stuff. So, I mean, we just call fishing game right away if it happens. But there is a time frame, I want to say 10 days, after the incident. But you have to forfeit the hide and the skull. It's not as big a deal as what a lot of people think. You know, the old adage is, oh, you better have scratch marks or blood on your face or something before you shoot one. You know, a grizzly bear and a brown bear, it's almost like a skunk or a raccoon in other places. You know, people recognize that they're a menace. As long as you're, you know, just see the bear 100 yards away because he's close, you shoot him. As long as you're not doing that, if you feel threatened and it's justified, then I've never really heard of anybody getting into too much trouble. One other thing I'll mention, the electric fences, the bear are battery-powered or solar-powered electric fences. Not a bad idea. I can tell you by firsthand knowledge, they don't always work, but I got to figure that oftentimes they will deter a bear from coming in. So that's not a bad idea to bring one along.
Any other advice for camp setup? Again, like going back and equating to maybe hunters in the lower 48 who might hang their food or something like that, but that's just not possible up in this area. How can we help keep a quote-unquote clean camp, if you will, if that's even possible, to try and deter or at least prevent some of these encounters?
Yeah, I used to put my food out from the tents, but honestly, I found that you pretty well got to protect it a little closer to the vest than that, and I usually just keep my food right in the tent. You know, because once they get in and they get a taste of something, then it's a lot harder to keep them away because they're going to come into your camp. These old bears, they're smart. I just had one last year. Like, I definitively watched, we shot a boar little bit of a long story, but this is how these bears are. They're very smart, and they get trained into hunters. They know what they can get away with. They know what they can't. They'll live sometimes over 30 years. So we were watching two grizzly bears in the Arctic. One was 5 miles away. One was 4. The bigger one was 5. Went over. We shot him. The other one was a mature boar, so he was our backup in case we didn't get the first one. So we shoot the big bear, and as we're skinning him, here comes this other boar walking right past us very fast. He's up on a ridge about 300 yards away, and he's looking at us as he's walking, but he's beelining it straight in this one direction, and it was just very odd bear behavior, and I couldn't figure out what he was doing. He just kept on walking. Well, then when the pilots picked up the bear hide, we came to find out that 3 days earlier, some do-it-yourself caribou hunters had a grizzly bear in camp, stole a bunch of their meat. And I said, well, where is this camp? And they pointed it out. It was about 4 miles beyond where we had shot this grizzly bear, and that's in direct line of where that bear was going. So that bear, when he heard us shoot, he figured it was the caribou camp from where he had stolen the caribou a few days earlier, and he was heading marching there immediately because he obviously had been trained that those gunshots mean an easy meal. So that's the first time that I've ever firsthand see it take place, that the old adage that gunshots are a dinner bell for the bears. It was absolutely 100% no doubt in my mind that was the case with this bear. So they're wise animals. If they can get away with something, they will.
Wow, that's crazy. Good thing we're bow hunting, Steve.
Yeah, that's funny because we had the same. Our caribou hunt 2 years ago, Lenny killed his caribou like 3 miles away. We packed it back to camp, and then mine I killed that night 200 yards from camp, and we had a grizzly bear not 600-700 yards up the hill, and we were definitely on edge all night long waiting to, you know, hear a bear rummage around the outside of the tent.
Did he ever come in?
Nope, never did. Yeah, or at least not that we know of. We had a fox drag some meat off, but that was about it.
Okay. Yeah, so some of them are honest. They're just like people. Some of them, they'll push the envelope, but others, you know, they know it's bad news and they'll stay away.
Yeah.
Oh, so I was joking, Billy, about us just bow hunting, because I think we're going to have a mix of weapons on the trip. But since I thought of that, do you have any thoughts on, for caribou specifically, on choosing weapon, maybe between bow, rifle, or if you have a guy who's, you know, primarily a bow hunter, would you recommend that he just brings a rifle as a backup? I know that's personal decision, but what are your thoughts on that in general?
Well, what I tell most clients, this is my firsthand experience. I've never shot a caribou. I've never shot any animal in Alaska for myself, as far as that goes. But what I have found is that for the guys who are on the fence, and if you bring two weapons, not saying that you shouldn't bring a rifle if you're a bow hunter, I think that's a good idea. But for a lot of guys, this is what happens. They get into a scenario, they see some caribou, and the whole time, this is their thought process and these are their words. Should I just bring the rifle? Should I leave the bow? Should I bring the rifle? What should I do? And it ruins the experience. So my suggestion is, if you're on the fence, just bring the rifle. Rather than, you know, taint your experience with a whole bunch of worry and stress, just enjoy the journey, the adventure, and just do the rifle. You've got a less than 10% chance of shooting something with a bow if you have a rifle along. On the average, you know, this is my experience. I'm all for a guy who's bringing a bow and just says, you know, I'm going to do it with a bow or nothing. I'm all for it. You know, not to say that if you bust the caribou and with the bow and they run out and they're 100 yards away and there's a rifle on hand, that I wouldn't grab the rifle and shoot it. But so it's kind of a personal question, I guess. Definitely bring a rifle for safety if for no other reason. But I guess just be honest with yourself on the forefront. You know, if you, you know, would rather go home with an animal than risk just trying with a bow and maybe not getting one. I guess my suggestion, if you're on the fence, leave the bow at home.
I didn't think of that line of thought, Billy, like on that decision adding stress. I didn't think of that in the forefront of my mind, but I think kind of subconsciously that's where I was at, because I've been wrestling on, you know, do I bring a bow? Do I bring a bow and a rifle? Do I only bring a bow and then use somebody else's rifle if I decide? And, you know, I kind of felt that, I didn't put that word to it, but I was kind of feeling that anxiety of like, this is making it more complicated than it probably needs to be, and somewhat taking away from the enjoyment of like, let's just go and have the experience type thing.
Both of my trips to Alaska, we did the exact same thing. It was, let's hunt with a bow, and then if it comes down to the last few days, we still haven't killed something, we'll pull a rifle out. And Billy mentioned you're packing that rifle regardless. But every single time, like when Lee killed his caribou that day, I was packing the rifle for him. He was the shooter, so he had his bow. And then we got to a point where it was like caribou were out there 150 yards, didn't think it was going to happen with a bow. So he handed me his bow, I handed him the rifle, and he went and shot it. And it definitely just adds that stress and that decision making, and especially, you know, you got an animal right there in front of you. I like Billy's advice there. If you're going to be happy killing with a rifle one way or other, just do it.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at. That's what I've been leaning to, and I guess it complicates it too a little bit because I'm left-handed and I've pretty much shot right-handed guns my whole life, so that wouldn't be an issue. But I'm like, nobody else is going to have a bow set up like mine, so I definitely have to bring my bow, clearly. And then in the end, that's what I came down to. It's like, I would be so happy just having this hunt and having this experience regardless of, you know, how I kill a caribou. And so that's pretty much, I was like, well, if I'm going to be happy killing it with a rifle, I'm just going to bring my rifle.
Yeah, and you're going to learn so much about caribou hunting. You know, if you're in a spot where they're crossing a river in front of you, if you're on a knoll, you've got a brushy creek bottom, you know, that's like a perfect setup for a bow hunter. But if you're just spotting and stalking through the open tundra, holy smokes, that's a tough challenge with a bow and arrow. It's tough enough with a rifle sometimes. So, yeah, so that's my best advice. I think you guys are absolutely right. You're already kind of feeling that angst or anxiety, whatever you want to call it. So, but to each his own, but that's just been my experience with guys in the past.
Yeah, good. So, on the topic of predators still, Billy, what about wolves? And even turning a caribou hunt into combination wolf hunt for non-residents in a lot of areas, from what I've seen, it's pretty reasonable to pick up a wolf tag as well. Is that correct?
Yep. Most areas that I know of, usually August 10th, some areas, to the best of my recollection, no closed season. Some areas, you don't even need a tag. But yeah, for the most part, it's like 10 wolves a year. So it's usually not many guys fill up on wolves in a 2-week hunt. So definitely get a tag. No matter where you are, you've definitely, you know, you've got a chance of seeing a wolf.
If we can, Billy, just get into a few gear topics while we have some time. One of the first things that came up for me when thinking about this hunt and planning for this hunt, and one of the first categories I was trying to make some decisions in, was understanding what to do for waders and boots. So, you know, hip waders versus over boots versus chest waders and that whole discussion. And again, that can obviously depend on exactly where you're headed. But what do you use and what do you recommend that guys consider for an Alaskan caribou hunt in terms of waders?
If you're getting dropped, are you guys getting dropped off with wheel planes on ridge tops?
Yeah, either that or it's a lake. They got a plane of floats last year, I believe, and so they're dropping off on some lakes. But pretty much it's going to be open tundra with a few river crossings.
Okay, what I use, what I prefer, so like when I go up, sometimes I'll go up in the fall for 3 months straight, so I've got to have stuff that's really versatile. What I generally use anymore is just Wiggy's waders, those little 1-pound nylon slip-on creek crossing. They last about 10 to 20 creek crossings and then they're shot, but that's what I bring just because they're light. You can pack them around. They're just made for crossing in a creek, not wading around in it. So if you're getting dropped off with a float plane, you're probably going to want real breathable waders, so I would try to nail them down, your air taxi on that. But I've had good luck with just hunting boots and gaiters, and then just using those Wiggy waders whenever I need to cross a creek. And, you know, if you've got somebody that doesn't have them, you can just put a rock in them, toss them across the creek to the next guy. They're pretty quick. And I don't like to have that. Waders, for me, they're a little bit cumbersome. when you're stalking, you know, going a long ways, having that restriction, that extra layer, it tires me out pretty quick. So I like the freedom of being able to take the waders off when I don't need them.
And what do you use for boots or recommend?
I use Crispies. I started using those a couple of years ago. I'm not even for sheep hunting, I'll use those. I don't really like real stiff boots. Right now I'm walking around in the woods with my dog. I've got a pair of Loas. Those are pretty good. The old original Mindels are pretty good. The ones with Cabela's name on them, they're comfortable, but they're pretty much junk. They don't last very long. Kenetreks, I think those are good. They'd never really worked for my feet. Definitely don't get them too close to a fire or a stove, or the sole will, the glue will let loose. I've had a lot of guys have that happen. They try to dry them out and then they let loose. But I think they're a pretty good boot. Sherpas are good. You know, I think that's all pretty much a personal preference for the most part.
Yeah.
But just like anything, you get what you pay for. You know, you're looking at $400 to get a good pair of boots. But I like the Crispies just because they're not too stiff. They can handle pretty much anything. So they're a good, happy medium for me, you know, using the same boot for sheep, brown bear, moose, caribou, everything.
Yeah. How do you feel just in general about leather versus synthetic for Alaska?
Are you talking like, I'm not super savvy with the synthetics. I've tried the Colflax, those hard plastic ski boots.
Yeah,
I didn't like them.
Right. Yeah. Do you tend to just stick to full leather then?
Yeah, I figure I look at the creator. If God made it or man made it, I'm going to go with whatever created. I find that's usually the best.
Nice.
I like it.
Just a big general question on shelters. As floorless shelters get more and more popular, how do those work out for Alaska, particularly in the tundra? Do you see those used much there? Would you recommend something a bit more traditional with a full bathtub? Give us some thoughts there.
This year I used one of the new Stone Glacier skyscraper tents. That's a good tent. If you're going to be pretty cozy with your buddy, that's for darn sure. You know, that's a sheep tent. We also used a Kafaru teepee. I think it was called the Tut. That teepee worked really good. The big disadvantage to a teepee is bugs, which can be brutal. I would definitely plan for bugs any time of year, but if you're going hunting in the Arctic before the 20th of August, they can, like, ruin your trip, potentially. So you definitely have to be ready for that. The teepee works good for cooking and just a shelter to get away and store your gear. And then if the weather is such, and they're light, you know, they're very lightweight, obviously. So they work pretty good for sleeping. I use them for spiking out when I'm sheep hunting. So that's been my experience with them. And usually there we're getting good, solid tundra, nice flat tundra. That isn't always the case where you're caribou hunting for sure. But I guess to answer your question, it's kind of a personal preference thing. Yeah, they could definitely work, but the biggest factor I would worry about on a caribou hunt is bugs. So if it were me, I would probably bring one and then bring like a minimalist tent, like the Stone Glacier I'm talking about, just something basically to sleep in. And then you can keep your cooking, that kind of stuff in your, teepee, and all your gear, you can keep it dry. That works out pretty good. I have used teepees for a number of years just for storage and cook in. So, yeah, I definitely would bring one.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, the idea of essentially like a camp-type shelter for, you know, as you mentioned, storage, cooking, drying, all that, versus separating that from a minimal sleep shelter was something I was considering for sure.
Yep, I would bring one for sure.
Cool. So mid-August to mid-September, again, Alaska conditions can vary, but what are your thoughts in general on sleeping bags and sleep system in terms of temperature rating for that time of year?
Okay, yeah, good question. 20 would be you definitely a 20 degree bag. I wouldn't want to go, you know, with anything higher than that. Zero probably wouldn't hurt. I've seen it get down into single digits in early August. and that's the warmest month of the year in the Arctic. So, yeah, zero doesn't hurt, 20 at a minimum. I just use a Mont Bell bag. I like that spiral design because it gives me a little more room. So I would probably go with a good new 20-degree bag. I like down just because of the weight factor primarily. That's probably a personal preference as much as anything, but you definitely got to keep that dry, obviously. So, yeah, 20 degrees would be, you definitely want to stay at that or lower for your temperature rating.
Okay. In terms of clothing, one thing I was thinking about for this trip was adding something like puffy pants. Are those something that you use?
Absolutely. Those quick zip-off ones. First Light's got a pair. Mont Bell's got some. I'm sure Kuyu has one. Sitka probably has them. They're probably all over the place. Definitely, I use those a ton. You know, you walk up to your hill, you get settled in. I like to bring a glassing chair with me because that's 95% of what you're doing on a caribou hunt is you're just sitting there. So just to be comfortable, get one of those canoe chairs, those foldable canoe chairs. And then, yeah, you zip on those puffy pants and, you know, you just ride it out and let your eyes do the walking.
What do you use for a glove system?
I've been using First Light, I think they call them grizzly gloves. They're like a glomet. They've got one finger and then your pointer finger is free. The other three fingers are in a mitten. Those are pretty good, you know, just for long-term sitting. Other than that, what I find works the best is just a simple pair of rag wool or even cotton. I just, like, we call them roper gloves. The Western guys will call them roper gloves. I'll just buy them at a Fleet Supply, 10 of them for 10 bucks or whatever they are. Bring a couple of pairs of those. Sitka Stormfront gloves are really good, too. So a good heavy-duty glove for glassing with a long gauntlet, you know, so the wrist is long to protect your wrist.
Got it.
And that's what I'd go with.
Yeah. So puffy pants, the gloves, a good glove system, and then obviously good rain gear. Kind of the three things that stood out to me in terms of clothing and accessories to make sure I get dialed, in addition to what I essentially already use for the lower 48. And obviously, I guess you could throw the waders or the overboots in with that. Is there anything else to you that stands out in terms of what guys with lower 48 hunting clothing and apparel and accessories have but should consider for Alaska to add on to their list?
I like a really good jacket. I work with First Light, and the one thing that I've been telling them in their line, kind of what they're missing for what I do, is a good, heavy, puffy jacket with a windproof shell. And they made one this year. They sent me one. I got to use it. I love it. I don't remember the model of it, but it's their heaviest jacket with a hood. So it's got a nylon shell, and then it's poly fiber anyway. So it dries out quick, and it cuts the wind, you know, so it's loud by, you know, Western standards. It might be a little bit loud, but that thing is worth its weight in gold for a hunt like that. The other thing, wool. I really like wool. Again, the maker of wool, that's what I'm going with. I've been using that now for 10 years. Of course, everybody's kind of, wool is hot again now. So I would definitely go with a wool layer against your skin. For me, wool underwear is a must. Chafing can be a big issue for those guys that have it or have had it. Man, it can be brutal. So I've never had an issue when wearing wool. So I always keep wool against my skin. Beyond that, not against my skin, then I always use synthetics. That's maybe just personal preference, but it seems to work best for me.
One question I had for you, Billy, is when we went up, they told us that we didn't have to filter water out of the creeks, that Giardia and stuff doesn't exist up there, which I was just like, thought was crazy, because we filter everything down here. But what's your experience there?
The only time I've ever got sick off of water, I thought it was going to kill me. I was off the Hall Road and was eating or drinking it out of a stream right off the road, and the water, it smelled a little funny, but I've drank all the water everywhere else on the north side. Never had any issues. And then a year later, there was a bunch of excavators digging in on the long side of that creek where we had taken the water. And me and the guy that I was with, like, I thought we were going to die, honestly. I mean, I was so delirious. I woke up in the middle of the night, it was the first year I'd ever hunted up there, so it was 19 years ago. We got in there late at night. The outfitter I was guiding for, he had just bought the camp, so it was just he and I. So I went in the creek, got some water, we drank some water, cooked supper, went to bed. Woke up in the middle of the night, my head was just pounding, the worst headache I ever had in my life, and I could barely walk. So I was in my underwear, stumbled outside to take a leak, and when I woke up, my underwear were around my ankles, and I was laying in gravel, and there was a pool of blood. I'd fallen, I'd passed out face first in the gravel, and I was just like hypothermic because it was like 40 degrees, you know? So I struck back into camp. My boss is like, "Willie, what the hell's the matter with you?" I said, "I don't know. I think I'm dying." And he said, "Well, let's get you to Fairbanks." And I'm like, "I'm going to be dead before we get to Fairbanks." That was 400 mile drive, you know? And so next thing I know, I'm trying to get some aspirin. And I remember falling down, hitting my head on a stool. And then I wake up and I look, and then there's my boss. He's laying beside me, and there's a big pool of vomit beside him. And I'm like, holy crap, you know, this is the way I'm going to go out. This is pretty inglorious, you know. And so I go to drink some water, and the water smelled like burnt, rotten pork chops. And I'm like, right then, I'm like, okay, this water is bad. And so anyways, we quit drinking the water, drank out of the river. You know, the water had a current. It was kind of like a tundra canal, really. So we took water out of the creek right next to it, and we were fine, didn't smell. And so we both were, you know, we both ended up just fine. It went away. And then the next year we came there, and there's excavators digging this hole right next to that creek. And we asked the excavators what they were doing. They said, oh, there was a chemical spill here in the 70s when they were putting in the pipeline. And so we're just here cleaning that up.
Oh, so out of goodness.
All that water that I've drank all over the years, you know, it was something man put there that almost killed us. So
now you don't have to filter water is what you're saying.
Yeah. If there's no beavers in it, I drink the beaver water. I've heard people say some people are immune to it. I grew up and I'm a terrible swimmer. I grew up swimming in lakes, so I've drank lots of beaver piss. I've never gotten it. But the city guys that drink the chlorinated water, they've gotten it before. If they're sloppy, pretty good chance they're going to get it. Not in the Arctic. There's no beavers. Not that you have to have beavers to get Giardia. You can get it from anything. But, yeah, we've never had any issue in the Arctic with water, as long as it's got movement to it.
Mm. Well, Billy, I know that, we have 2 hours worth of conversation here, and I still have other questions and things like that. I'm sure listeners do too, but I also know you have some good resources out there in terms of your gear lists and obviously your hunting films, and you even have some new projects in the works. Where would you point listeners to if they want to kind of either just learn more about hunting in Alaska in general or check out some of the resources that you have to offer specifically?
My website would be the best location. You can just Google search the modern day mountain man and you'll find my stuff. Or my website is Billy Molls, M-O-L-L-S, adventures.com. Yeah, ever since I started in Alaska 21 years ago, I've been filming all the hunts and producing videos. About 12 years ago, I started producing videos. Did a little bit of freelance writing, wrote a book, working on a second one now. My latest project is a sheep hunting DVD that I think, whether you're a sheep hunter or not, I'm really excited for this one to come out. It'll be out in a week or so. The other project that I'm working on is a workout DVD that's specifically designed for hunters. So it'll minimize your workout time, maximize your efficiency. And it's a 3-workout set, and it's for guys of any fitness level. I mean, it kicks my butt when I do it, but there's most of the movements have an alternative method to make it a little bit easier if you need it as you're going through it. But in essence, the video allows you, it has an instructional version and an advanced version. The instructional versions, like any other hunting DVD or a workout DVD rather, shows someone demonstrating the movements and a trainer describing the techniques and what you're working on. And then once you master the movements, you would move on to the advanced version of each workout, by which each movement is introduced, one repetition is shown, and then the repetitions go to a small corner screen, and then the main screen comes alive with Alaska hunting footage. So you basically get to watch, you know, 65-inch bull moose and 10-foot bears and herds of caribou and doll sheep. And you're watching a hunting video as you're working out to help motivate you and inspire you all the time. I have a general motivational voiceover going on throughout each video. So I'm pretty excited. I know it's going to help a lot of guys out. I think that holds a lot of people back, hunting in Alaska or just life in general, you know, is that fear or question, hey, can I handle this? Is this something I can do? This is designed to help guys realize their dream hunts, is to give them the confidence that, hey, I can tackle this. I can climb these mountains. I can get this done. So that's my latest, and I think guys are really going to benefit from it. I'm excited for it to get released. I think it's a real good product. It's going to help a lot of guys realize their hunting ambitions.
Yeah, that sounds unique for sure. I like it. Can you spill the beans on what your second book that you're working on is about?
Yeah, my second book, the working title is God and Grizzly Bears. You know, I think part of the, really what Alaska is about for me is the adventure. Getting yourself, not necessarily that you have to throw yourself into it, but, you know, Alaska is, I think part of the mystique and the mystery is that it's harsh, it's lonely, it's unforgiving, and you hit it hard enough and you do it enough, sooner or later, you're going to find yourself in a position where you're not sure that you can overcome it. And the old adage is adventure begins when things go wrong. You go hunting in Alaska in 10 days, to some degree or another, something's going to go wrong. And I think that's what makes it addicting, is that you learn more about yourself, what you're capable of, and what's really valuable to you in life. And that's what basically the whole gist and the premise of God and Grizzly Bears is going to be, is what I've learned through the times where I thought I was going to die in a river, or airplane crashes, or one thing or next, is how you get out of it, what you learn from it. And for me, that's what hunting in Alaska is all about, the personal journey.
That's cool.
Yeah, well said.
Well, Billy, man, appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yep, my pleasure, guys. Happy to do it anytime.
Well, that's a wrap on these conversations with Billy. As he mentioned, don't forget, you can check out BillyMallsAdventures.com to see everything that he's up to. So whether that's the training stuff or films, or you're interested in hunts and guiding, like, there's so much there. So go check it out. Shoot Billy a message if you have any questions for him, and I know that he'll be happy to help. Again, thank you for tuning in. We will catch you next week.